20, which is about single systems. If you know about contextuality, anything, you know that typically it's discussed in a single system. So thank you very much. So after Valerio, I might have titled my talk. Oh, no, I have several. One is larger than zero, maybe just a little bit, but still enough to give a talk about it. Okay, so what I'm going to speak about is joint work with Adam Cabello and Simone Severini. So there's a preprint here that's out there already for a while that you might have seen or not. This is more or less the structure, so I want to review a little bit the origin of the contextuality discussion with Gleason theorem and Bell, Koch, and Specker. Then I want to go to some abstract notions that we call compatibility structure. I discuss some examples, and I will use this abstract structure to discuss general probabilistic models, including quantum mechanics and including classical probability and inequalities. So that's kind of inspired by work of Kliatchko et al. We take a bit of a departure from the usual discussion of Koch and Specker as a logical impossibility result towards something that looks more like Bell inequality, where you assign different values to different classes of theories. And if I have time, I want to talk a little bit about the application of these ideas to the multi-party setting, where these inequalities turn out to be Bell inequalities. All right. So since it's here, in the abstract, I said something that I want to talk a little bit also about a hierarchy of semi-definite relaxations for the quantum value of maximal Bell violations. But, due to time, I think I will skip that. Also because in discussion with Miguel Navasquez, I recently found out that actually this hierarchy that I had is actually just a bizarre reformulation of the hierarchy that he has with Stefano Peronio and Tony Asin. So let's get started. So the starting point of a lot of foundation stuff is, spoken or unspoken, the probabilistic nature of quantum mechanics. So, I mean, quantum mechanics tells us how to calculate expectation values and how to calculate probabilities even more. If for example, this X here is a projection onto a subspace or more generally a PFM element. And sometimes I get the impression that people are kind of happy with this. This is kind of considered to be the grounding of quantum mechanics. Quantum mechanics might be weird, but it relates to probabilities. In a certain sense, I always feel a bit uneasy about this. I mean, maybe this is the one conference to speak about such things, since I heard other people talking about personal sentiments about scientific questions. And that's because I think that even probability is weird. I mean, we don't really know what probability is in the same way as we know other facts in the surrounding world. And a characteristic feature of probability is that we have a mathematical theory that just axiomatically tells you how to calculate things. Again, it doesn't explain to you what the probabilities are. And we kind of sometimes forget this because we think maybe they are weird, but they are maybe less weird and less hard to understand than quantum mechanics. Nevertheless, I will take probability theory for granted, like most of the speakers here. I will talk freely about general probabilistic models and stuff like that. And anyway, this is just the starting point. So we have this Born rule, and it gives us, as I said, a way of calculating probabilities for each measurement. And in fact, we have a probability value associated to each measurement outcome, to each PFM element. And okay, that's kind of an early realization that, that originated somewhere in the early foundations discussion. Of course, since everything is just down to these probabilities, there is an underlying probability space. I mean, that's thanks to Kolmogorov. We know how to construct this probability space that somehow contains, if not explains, it contains all the probability distributions for all these measurements that I want to make. Yeah, and notice that I'm talking here about POVMs and not about individual outcomes. So Kolmogorov, as I said, will teach us how to construct some probability space, how to construct a probability measure, and then from this measure, you basically just have to calculate some marginal to figure out the probabilities of any given measurement, right? And it's something that, that would be called a, a classical hidden variable theory, except that I guess it was Bell who noticed that it is kind of a bit of a weird model, because it does not identify the outcomes, but you have to talk about the complete measurement. So any kind of such model that you would make based on the prescription I gave is contextual in the sense that a given outcome, for example, a projector in quantum mechanics, is represented by different events. An event in probability language is a subset of the probability space. It's the set of all the sample points where the event takes place. So the same outcome might be represented by different events depending on in which context it occurs, in which measurement, in which complete POVM it is one of the outcomes. And as I said, Bell was the one that realized that this is a necessity. And his proof was based on, I mean, his argument was based on something that he knew from the literature, this Gleason theorem, that is going back to, that is a theorem that has to do with this thing here, this observation that that in quantum mechanics, there is a way of calculating these probabilities by just knowing the one measurement outcome. You don't need to care about the context. So it's just a probability, so it's between 0 and 1. And the Gleason theorem is a very simple mathematical statement. It says, in a Hilbert space of dimension at least 3, if you consider functions that take values between 0 and 1 on all the projectors, that have this property that it looks like they could figure as probabilities in measurements. So in particular, if you have a complete set of projectors, so the sum of projectors is identity, then the sum of these values has to be 1. And Gleason says, well, this can only be possible if you have the Born rule with a particular density operator. So that's a statement of analysis. How does it relate to this non-contextuality, to this hidden variable discussion? Well, this is, as I said, this is Bell's realization. For a hidden variable model, this valuation would be really the expectation value of something classical. So there would be some hidden variable condition on which V takes only values 0 and 1. But we would still have the same, rule here. If you have a complete measurement, exactly one of the outcomes has to occur and the others not. I mean, meaning that one of the values is 1 and the others are 0. Right, so this is ruled out by the Gleason theorem, because these functions here, they are continuous. You cannot find a state row such that the values are only 0, 1. You must also admit all the values in between. And, this is the corollary. There can be no non-contextual classical hidden variable model for the propositions of quantum mechanics. If the propositions are these projections. So what we call Cochen-Specker theorem is basically another corollary, because from statements of logic, these two guys, they are actually logicians, you know that there must be a finitary proof of this. I mean, Gleason theorem involves the whole Hilbert space. It's kind of you have to make some continuity argument. But if you just want to have this contradiction, if you just want to have this statement, if you have a function that takes values between only 0 and 1, then this relation must be violated for at least one complete set of projectors. There must be a finitary version of this, if you just want to arrive at this contradiction. And so finitary means you just look at finitely many projection operators. The first proof of Cochen-Specker used 117 one-dimensional projections in three-dimensional Hilbert space. And here is a diagram of the orthogonality relations between these projections, or between these states, if you want. Projections of one-dimensional spaces. And you see there are lots of triangles in this graph of the orthogonality relation, meaning that there are lots of complete bases. So there are lots of non-trivial relations according to this Gleason condition. In the meantime, lots of other people found smaller sets, and I believe that the current record is just above 30 for three dimension and 18 vectors, or 18 one-dimensional projections in four dimensions. So I hope, well, to some degree, this should be all well-known stuff. If it wasn't, this is kind of the introduction to Bell, Croce, and Speicher without making too much fuss about the combinatorics. So, I want to discuss in kind of coming to the work I did with Adan and Simone. I want to discuss basically an abstraction of this thing that avoids the contradiction. I mean, it's an interesting thing that Bell, Croce, and Speicher is just a logical theorem. It just says, well, you can't find this violation. So it's kind of logically inconceivable to have this local this classical non-contextual hidden variable model. I want to present an abstract way of talking about these outcomes and measurements that is flexible enough so that every constraint structure that we have here, I mean, constraints in the Croce and Speicher theorem are due to the orthogonality relation and due to the fact that this one and the same outcome can occur in different measurements, even though these measurements may not be compatible. So it goes like this. It's kind of an ad hoc thing, which I don't even claim a particular novelty. I think this probably was considered by the likes of Bell already. So if we want to discuss something like this Bell argument, for the logic of the argument, we identify a set of outcomes. So these, I call them atomic events. If you think about a quantum mechanical setting, you might have, this might be that in really the outcomes of measurements that are allowed in the current consideration. But of course, you might have several measurements. What do you do if measurements commute? Well, atomic means it's the most informative type of event. So you're supposed to make, with any measurement, find a maximal set of mutually commuting measurements. That is a maximally refined experiment in the given scenario. And so each of these events, I mean, logically speaking, is not the union or the OR, to be precise, of two more elementary events. Right? So I want to talk about finite sets, so then there is no issue about improbability here. And so these are the atomic events, the most elementary propositions you can make about your system. And you have a bunch of context. So I'm in front of the wrong audience here, but for already when you write down these two things, you have a set and you have a set of subsets of this set. Combinatorialists love this. This is a hypergraph. It's a generalization of a graph structure. So gives them a lot of ideas. That's why I did it too. But what it really is, it's just a set of particular subsets of V. Each of these subsets I call a context. And a context is just, well, it's a set of what I call outcomes. I think in the paper we call them propositions, but okay. Names are exchangeable anyway. The interpretation that, of course, I'm not giving, this is just a logical structure. The idea that you should have in mind is the outcomes in a context, they are possible as outcomes in a joint measurement. I'm not saying that they are the outcomes, there might be others, but this context C, subset of V, is a set of outcomes. There exists a measurement that has these things as the outcomes. And this is, I mean, this very important point for this whole contextuality discussion. The same outcome can feature in different contexts, can feature in different measurements. It's one of the very important logical and also interpretational points of this whole non-contextuality. Oh, yeah, not again. Please. Where are you? Okay, I'm a bit too slow. It just tells me that I'm too slow. Okay, so as I said, this is just a logical structure. As in logic, we need to find a model to realize this, to fill this with meaning. And it goes like this. So classical model is, as you would expect, is a bit like on the very first slides. I need a measure space. So there's this set omega. That's all the possible samples. And I need subsets, EI, for each outcome. So these EI, they are events in the probabilistic language. And because the outcomes are meant to be atomic, I cannot have two of them appearing, if two outcomes are in one common context, it means that there are possible values of a random variable, of a random observation, then it means the corresponding events have to be different. Because I will not allow that the value is I and J at the same time. That would contradict the atomicity assumption. Right, so this is an axiom for these models. I mean, the compatibility structure demands that if you build a model, it has to satisfy this. I do not ask that the union of all the events in a context is equal to omega. I stress it again. And this is just a little mathematical point that kind of makes it easier to go to the quantum case. If you think of these events in terms of the random variable, that is just the indicator function of the set. So it's one, it's kind of a click. If you land inside the set, it's zero. No click if you're outside. Then the context, they come into the game like this. There's an algebraic relation. The sum of all these functions over one context is less than or equal to the function that's equal to one. That should kind of prepare the ground for the quantum model, because it's just the usual quantization. All the numbers become operators. You need, for a quantum model of the same compatibility structure, you want a Hilbert space, projection operators in this Hilbert space, such that for all contexts, the sum over these projections is less than or equal to identity. So meaning that these guys can be completed to a full measurement. Yeah, and I want projections as I wanted events before, because I don't want to introduce a kind of another fuzziness. I mean, if I allow POVM elements, then it's a bit like injecting randomness in the projection. In the measurement. Then I don't have this exclusiveness anymore. Then there's no way of talking about, of formalizing that only one or the other event can occur. Okay, so given one of these models, in either case, classical or quantum model, since I prepared the ground already in the classical model, I wanted the probability space. What happens if I have a probability measure? Well, then I can calculate expectation values of these indicator functions / projection operators, and they are really the probability that the outcome I occurs in a measurement that contains PI as a measurement operator. So these are some values, weights between 0 and 1. I mean, they're really probabilities. And of course, because of this property, they inherit the fact that the sum of these numbers is upper bound by 1, if a sum of an arbitrary context. Again, that's because this is a subset of possible outcomes in a measurement. Otherwise, we contradict our notion of probability. So if I just forget about all the previous thing and just focus on these numbers, that's a bit like the stuff in the Gleason theorem. You just have this catalog of numbers. And so that's why a list of numbers that satisfies this inequality for all contexts in the given compatibility structure, I call this a Gleason model. But I guess, again, these names are, I don't want to get stuck on names. And yeah, okay, this is for the graph theories. Let's forget about that. So since it's already day three of a conference that is packed with general probabilistic models, I don't feel ashamed bringing this up here. But I will do it very briefly. So once you're familiar with this way of talking about state preparation measurements, that is generalized probabilistic models, it's kind of fairly straightforward how to formalize a generalized model for this compatibility structure. So what you need is, of course, one of these generalized probabilistic models. So you need an observable space, positive cone. You need you need this unit element with certain properties with respect to this cone, and then the states are positive linear functionals that are normalized on this cone, normalized on this unit element. So we want, for this generalized model, we need to assign generalized effects to each outcome, and we want that they can occur in the same measurement. So again, the sum is upper bound by unity. And you introduce another few. Okay, so let's not talk about this. If you don't know generalized probabilistic models, you won't learn it from me. If you do, this is redundant for you. Also, this kind of definition of effect is like in quantum mechanics. And yeah, so I need also to, for what I'm talking about, I need some kind of extra assumption that somehow abstracts from this property that I had before, that I want projection operators, not just any old effect. And so what I want is that all these pi and also the deficit, u minus the sum of pi over a context, should be sums of extremal and normalized effects. So this sounds like a very strong condition. It rules out a large number of things, but okay, I don't want to go into the mathematical theory of these things. So the upshot is this generalized probabilistic theory is just essentially a way of harnessing convex geometry so that we can talk about linear functions as if they were states. So they give probability values on effects. And, the generalized probabilistic model is simply a way of adapting this to this compatibility structure. Okay, so by now, I trust you're completely lost with definitions and abstractions. So it's time to go back to something simple. It's a particular compatibility structure that I call the pentagon. You'll see if you look at the definition why. And I should really say this is the inspiration for the whole thing that we did. It appeared in a paper of Alexander Klyachko and collaborators. So I have five elementary outcomes. And the contexts are the following two element subsets. So they said it contains 1, 2, 2, 3, 3, 4. So it's only, all the contexts have only two elements. So I can draw the compatibility structure as this graph, simply with the vertices 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and you have two connected if they form a context. So let's look. I want to show you that there is indeed a classical model for this. I mean, there are plenty of them. But this is maybe an interesting one. So the underlying probability space is just V, happens to be the set of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And EI, for each vertex in the graph, EI is the set of neighbors. So each one has two neighbors. One, for example, has 2, 5 as neighbors. 2 has 1, 3, etc. So here's the list. And what do I need? I need that for neighboring vertices in the graph, I mean, that's the condition for neighboring vertices in the graph, the corresponding EI and EJ are disjoint. And okay, that's what they are. I mean, it's easy to check, either from the way I define it or just by hand going through the list. And of course, a state is simply just a probability distribution on this set here. So it's nothing outlandish. So what Klyachko and collaborators observed is that these constraints that we have on classical model, I mean, this is what I wrote here, is not just true for this particular model. It's true for any classical model and any distribution on the ground set. The sum of these expectation values of the PI, so it's the sum of the probability that this can occur, is at most 2. And a simple way of seeing this is, is that in the pentagon, for attaining the maximum value, well, okay, so already we're getting towards the calculation of this. to attain the maximum value here, realize, well, there's some convexity going on, so it's enough to concentrate on extremal distributions. So it's enough to just put a weight 1 on one of these points and weight 0 on all the others. And then it's basically just in how many contexts can a single point occur, and you just have to convince yourself that the disjointness relations, they make sure that it can be at most 2. So here comes a quantum model that, as I said, the inspiration is this paper of Klatschko et al., but in fact, in the 70s already, foundationalists and mathematicians were interested in such things. So how does the quantum model work? We pick three-dimensional Hilbert space. In fact, the picture I draw is only the Euclidean, the real section. It's enough for this purpose here. The model requires that I come up with these projection operators. Well, they are going to be one-dimensional projections onto vectors here. And the vectors have to be such that outcomes in the same context have to be assigned vectors that are mutually orthogonal. So 1 has to be orthogonal to 5, V1 to V5, N to V2, V2 to V3, etc. And you can convince yourself that there is a way of making such an arrangement that is obtained by lying the 5 vectors in a regular pentagon on the floor in the 2 space, and then just lifting it up, which means that they become more and more parallel. At a certain point, at a certain height, these orthogonality relations will be true. So for a particular state, if you take as the state the one that points in the projection in this up direction, we get that the sum of these expectation values is square root 5. So this is an inequality-based proof of quantum contextuality. It's really in the same spirit, only avoiding, instead of arguing by contradiction, we just look at the maximum value of some numerical quantity, which, interestingly, only refers to observables, right? I mean, if we really think that our theory corresponds to something in the lab, we know how to build a projection or how to build something that has a given operator as an outcome. And we can make measurements with it. So, in fact, this square root 5, didn't say that, is the maximum possible. Speed up a bit. That is something due to... Well, I don't remember. Klatschko et al. Might have proved this in dimension 3, and then there is a more recent paper by... I forget the first name of your co-author. Yes, thanks. Okay, Rob is sitting here. And so it's a paper by Rob and co-authors, where they use semi-definite techniques to show that this is the maximum in any dimension. So for over all possible quantum models, if you want. Well, okay, since I introduced them, let's also talk a bit about these Gleason models. The only constraints for Gleason models, I just need to assign these numbers. So I don't even talk about where they come from. I just say, well, there is some mechanism that produces these probabilities. And of course, they have to be behaviors probabilities, so they have to be non-negative. And the sum over each context is at most 1. Well, what I should do is I just make all the sums, all the context sums equal to 1, which is attained when all these weights are equal to 1/2. And that gives a value of 5 over 2, which is, of course, even larger than square root 5. Sorry, I wanted to go back a little bit. So there is something interesting there already. I mean, already when I assign these values 1/2 to all of them, you know already that something is certainly non-quantum here. Because in the quantum mechanical case, of course I have, for example, V1 orthogonal to V3, but that's not a complete measurement yet. To make a complete measurement, I need something that goes in yet another direction. It's orthogonal to both of them. So each of these 5 contexts would require introducing another vector, making it in total 10 vectors to really talk about complete measurements. And even, and of course, since it's a non-trivial vector and this row here is just the vertical direction, also this third probability is non-zero. I mean, you calculate all of them are equal the same. They are 1 over square root 5. They don't sum up to they don't sum up to 1 if you add up the probability of 1 and 5. So here, this is the case. So I have these potentially incomplete measurements, but so I might require other effects to complete it to a POVM in whatever model I have. But the probabilities of the effects I'm looking at, these five, they're already enough. They just give 5/2. Okay, so I want to rush through a little bit of the abstract thing that, I mean, okay, this is leading, it's probably more interesting to the mathematicians because it turns out that a lot of this stuff, a lot of these numbers that we encounter, a lot of the structures we encounter have been looked at already in graph theory for a long time. So from the physical point of view, even though this is a grand word when talking about such things, if you want to probe such a compatibility structure, so I mean, this kind of obvious assumption that you know for some reason that your experiment or your set of experiments is described by this given compatibility structure, the accessible values, I mean, the operationally accessible values are these expectation values, these probabilities here. So if you talk about inequalities, just like in Bell inequalities, you should talk about numbers that are really measurable. And that's kind of the philosophy here. We could talk about the structure of a given quantum model, but all we want to do here is we want to see what is the signature of the chosen class of model on the possible set of expectation values, just as I showed you with the pentagon. If you restrict to classical models, you get some set of values, and the sum of all the PI, all the WI cannot be larger than something. It can be larger for quantum. It can be even larger for more general models. So I just want to kind of do the same thing in the most general case without referring to too much of the particular compatibility structures. And so if you believe that you have a set of experiments that realize a given compatibility structure, you can run, and of course also you have to believe that you have a mechanism to prepare the same state or the same underlying distribution over and over again. You can collect statistics and you can measure all these numbers here, and you get a point in some high-dimensional Euclidean space that record, or the list of all these numbers here. That's this vector W. And basically, I want to say something about the possible statistics I can gather in this way if I know some, if I make some assumptions on the underlying model for the given compatibility structure. And so I get these sets E sub C, E sub quantum mechanics, E sub GPT, and the Gleason or fuzzy models. And so they are all convex sets nested within each other. And basically the theory of these inequalities, like the Klatschko inequality, is how to differentiate between these sets. How different are they? Are they different at all? How do I find this out? And so the first thing is, which I'm not going to show you, well, I wouldn't even show you if I have more time, that these fuzzy models are the same as the ones, the vectors, the observable vectors of fuzzy models are the same as the ones I can model by generalized probabilistic theories. So that requires finding for each set of values WI that satisfy the Gleason condition and particular suitable generalized probabilistic theories, effects, etc., that give me these numbers here as expectation values. So even though I don't show you the proof, there is an interesting consequence for that. It means that this is maybe a bit overstated. I mean, I'm saying the corollary is we know everything about the values we can find with the generalized probabilistic models, everything in the sense, for example, if you want to maximize any linear function, well, it's just linear programming because the E sub F is defined by linear inequalities. And, to compare the others, we do something like Klatschko. We look at some linear function, as here. For example, simply the sum of all the weights. Is it natural or not? I don't know, but it's some interesting thing to do. It generalizes Klatschko. And we get maximum values. So all of them are convex optimization problems. They were attained on some extremal point of these convex sets. And I would just like to discuss a little bit what these numbers are. So the first thing is how the graph theory comes into the game. The maximum of beta over classical models, this is something called the independence number of a particular graph that is derived from the compatibility structure. I call two outcomes, I and j, adjacent, if they do occur in some common context. So that's a, I mean, I lose some information because I lose how many contexts there are that contain I and j, how large they are, and so on, but it is a signature of the compatibility structure. So this here is the, this maximum beta is the independence number of this adjacency graph. Independence number is the maximum size of an independent set of, in V, of vertices. Independent meaning that two vertices are pairwise non-adjacent in the set. So why is that? Because we know that, maybe I write it even somewhere so you can try to read and listen at the same time. So we know that it's a, the maximum is attained at an extremal point. So we can, since we talk about models, it's enough to talk about extremal probability distributions, whatever the model in terms of events and so is. So the values here, they are either 0 or 1. And so what I know is that in each context, I can have at most 1, 1, and all the others must be 0. I can have all of the elements, all of the Ws in a single context would be 0, but to get the maximum, of course, I should try to make them larger. So, and that means that whenever two outcomes I and j are adjacent, they cannot be both labeled 1. Yes, okay. Oops, I thought we started a bit later, already, but never mind. Okay. So that means the set of all I such that Wi is equal to 1 is an independent set in this adjacency graph. I mean, it's probably a bit very slow and redundant. And more generally, this curly set E sub C is simply the convex hull of all the indicator functions of independent set in this adjacency graph. Well, already from this independence number, we know that since this is well known to be NP complete, and in fact, because it's in, the E sub C involves all these other independence numbers, we know that practically everything we want to know about E sub C is hard to compute, like this maximum beta here. And I said this GPT is easy. Well, actually, let's not go into this. It's just a linear program that is in combinatorics is known as the fractional packing number, but it's really just what you expect. It's the maximum sum of the weights subject to the constraints of the Gleason, model. Well, what I really should get to is the quantum models. That is maybe the most surprising thing that, at least for us, was a bit of a shock. That, first of all, this maximum is a known number. It's known since 1979. It's called the Lovers number or the theta function, which is given by this one here. It's the maximum norm of this operator, the sum of the one-dimensional projections over this VI, such that the VI form an orthonormal representation of G, meaning that if I and J are adjacent, remember, in the same context, then the vectors have to be orthogonal to each other. And, well, orthonormal. They are normalized vectors. Let's not prove this either. I mean, it's kind of more or less obvious once you go through the definitions. Again, I mean, the crucial thing you have to observe is to get the maximum, it's enough to consider a pure state. I mean, among the distributions, it's enough to go to the extremal ones, and that helps you to go from general projections to one-dimensional projections. So one of the cool things about this Lovers number is that it's a semi-definite program. It's maybe not obvious from the definition I gave, but in the paper of Lovers, there are about half a dozen of different formulations of this number, and two of them are semi-definite programs. And, more generally, I mean, instead of writing this down, I write down the semi-definite program for any function that is like this. You want to sum a linear combination with coefficients lambda I of this wi. I assume here that they are non-negative for reasons that you will see in a moment. Then this maximum is the maximum of the trace of lambda times t, where lambda is a fixed constant matrix, and t obeys certain semi-definite linear constraints. And this is basically just stealing from Lovaas, 1979. And so since these are all semi-definite programs, we can conclude that all computations in the sense of deciding membership, deciding computing maxima of linear functions over the set or of convex function over the set is efficient. You can do these kind of things efficiently. Okay, so unfortunately, I don't have a lot of time now for this application here. You might have wondered already, because I was going slow, so I guess I gave a lot of time to think about other stuff. You might have wondered, so in which sense does this generalize discussions of non-locality at all? And it goes like this. It's not particularly obvious, maybe, but it's actually quite simple. If we do have the usual setting where you have, let's say, let's discuss two parties, of Alice has a number of settings and outcomes, Bob has a number of settings and outcomes, which are modeled by corresponding projection operators in suitable Hilbert spaces. One of the things is, of course, all of Alice's measurement commute with all of Bob's. And so we can actually form a more refined measurement by looking at what happens if each of them makes a choice of measurement. So we have a product here, really. P of AB given XY is just the product operator. Of course, they commute. And so the atomic outcomes are just these quadruples, A, B, X, Y. And I have an edge in the adjacency graph. I mean, I don't even talk about the full compatibility structure, but just about when can two outcomes occur in the same measurement. Well, if the corresponding projectors are forced to be orthogonal due to the model, and that is exactly the case if either X is equal to X prime, for two such things, and outcomes are different. I mean, Alice does the same measurement but considers different outcomes, or Bob has the same measurement and considers different outcomes. And the hypergraph or the compatibility structure might be all the cliques, all the maximally mutually adjacent subsets of this graph. So I don't know if I really have to. Yeah, okay, never mind it. So forget about the notes. Since we do not necessarily assume that we know what the complete measurements are, our contexts always just say, well, these are two outcomes that can occur in the same measurement, but we don't know what we need to add to make it a complete measurement. The interesting thing about this models that I was discussing as probabilistic models is that if you sum over a context, for example, this here, I mean, if you fix X and Y and you sum over all the outcomes, this clearly is a context in my definition. So it's all the possible A, B, X, Y for fixed X, Y are mutually adjacent. The probability sums up to less than or equal to 1. So I have to put this in by hand that is equal to 1. Otherwise, I don't get complete measurements. And then I can do the same kind of thing with this. And I find, okay, sorry. I put in the constraint that I have the probability 1 here, which is just another linear constraint. So it's intersecting a convex set with a hyperplane, with a bunch of hyperplanes. And what we get is that this set here, so it's just kind of basically building the correct compatibility structure, adding in another linear constraint. This set here is exactly the correlations observable by local hidden variable models. And this guy here, up there, this is exactly the set of no signaling correlations. And unfortunately, of course, we have a bit of a problem down here because this is an efficiently described convex set, so it cannot be equal. Well, most likely it's not equal to the set of quantum mechanical correlations. This you get here. If you go back to actually the model, and instead of putting the sum of the probability equal to 1, you do as a good quantum mechanic, I suppose, should do, you just operatorize this, and you just say the sum of these outcomes here, the sum of the projections has to be equal to 1. That is enough to make this set, so it's a kind of a particular set of observable expectation values under this constraint that the model has to satisfy these relations. This is exactly equal to the quantum correlations in this bipartite setting of input X and Y and outcome A and B. Okay, so we can, which means, of course, we can calculate Bell inequality violations or at least get bounds by this semi-definite programming. And just to get closer to the conclusions, initially we didn't know very much about the relation between this curly E with a superscript 1 and the curly E with a superscript identity operator. And okay, this resolved now with the hierarchy, so we just went about testing this for some Bell inequalities, and one of them was the CHSH inequality, and there indeed, these are the maximum values of beta, which in the classical case, in the non-contextual case, is the independence number, is the theta for the quantum case, and is this fractional packing number of a particular graph for the generalized probabilistic models, meaning for non-signaling. And not very surprisingly, at least, we get exactly the values that we know. I mean, if you divide by 4, these are just the winning probabilities in the Popescu-Rolle game. And then we did the same thing for the Collins-Gisa inequality, and we get kind of close, but not quite close to the best possible, to the best known value of this. So again, this is a different normalization from these papers here. So basically, all of what's written here is an offset plus 6. So whereas the original Collins-Gisa inequality was written in such a way that the maximum classical value is 0, and then you have some slightly above 0. So this number here is just a semi-definite program. That's kind of the upshot of this whole slide. We get an upper bound on this number, which is slightly better. Okay, so maybe I use the remaining minus 2 minutes to conclude. Okay, so what I basically want to advertise is something that, of course, Pietschko et al. Already did. They said, You might get a bit of a more flexible view of this whole Koch and Specker approach to hidden variable theories by going to inequalities instead of looking at these logical contradiction proofs. And one kind of nice thing is that since this contains Bell inequalities, you might look for kind of similar but maybe easier to understand effects like violations in this kind of scenario. So, for example, in Bell inequalities, it took people a long time to understand how large can the violations be. And in fact, we're still not quite there for a given number of settings and outcomes of Alice and Bob. What's the largest quantum violation with respect to the largest classical value in this setting here? Because I just have to choose a graph. I don't have to do anything else. I can use graph theoretical results to find examples of very large violations. So, for example, it's known that there are graphs on n vertices. So, I need to consider globally n atomic outcomes, where the independence number is log n, and but the theta is square root n. So, this is the maximum classical value and the maximum quantum value. And there are others where the quantum value scales as some other polynomial of n, and the independence number or the classical value is even constant. So it's kind of, here's an exponential, and here's, if you want, an infinite separation. And, this one is a stupid question. Let's focus on this one here. Just one thing to concentrate on. So since I said that you can think of Bell inequalities and the violation in quantum and generalized signaling models, etc., as special cases of these non-contextual inequalities, it's quite interesting to think about if it's also possible to go the other way around, to associate to each non-contextual inequality in the sense that I presented here, a multipartite game whose violation corresponds to the violation of this non-contextual inequality. So this is not just empty talk. I mean, there are certain classes of non-contextual inequalities where it's known how to do this, and it's not even, I mean, it didn't require my genius to see this. This was noticed a number of times before, I think. But all these constructions exploit particular structure in the Koch and Specker proof. And as far as I know, there is no known way of just taking a generic non-contextual inequality and its quantum violation and lift it to a violation of a matching Bell inequality by somehow distributing measurements over two parties. So I like this question because it has to do with something which is a bit of a pain in this whole non-contextual debate, in the whole consideration of non-contextuality and quantum contextuality, in particular once you go to these inequalities, because I made a big fuss about how I only talk about measurable quantities. So again, it's very tempting to go, oh, now of course we can make an experiment, just like Bell experiment. And it's not that simple, unfortunately. And it would be, so it's, we can't just go and make a test in a single system and then claim that nature is quantum contextual. So doing such a thing, lifting these inequalities to a bipartite setting, it would get around some of these known issues that I'm sure someone will raise, but I won't mention. Thank you very much.
Okay, we have time for some short questions.
How arbitrary is the Gleason condition? I mean, because couldn't I decide to fix the higher moments, for example?
The higher moments of what?
Of the projection operator. So rather than looking at the probability and fixing that for each thing, just fixing the square or something.
So you mean so that I'm not forced to talk about projections and I can allow other things. That's what you're saying?
Yeah, the restriction that you put on your model is that you restrict that those are probabilities, but you could imagine.
Yeah, I guess you could do such a thing. I mean, I'm not really sure why you would want it other than allowing some flexibility in the physical description, because somebody might come and say, oh, but you never realize a projector, you realize some other thing that is a POVM element. And so I guess all you want, I mean, at least if that's your motivation, then all you have to ask is that you're sufficiently close to a projection, which, yeah, can be done in these kind of models. It just introduces small epsilons in everything. No.
No, I guess I mean, for your generalized probabilistic theories, the only...
I think the mic is off.
Is it going? The only thing you restrict is just that these probabilities are fixed in each context, and I'm just wondering why why choose that restriction and not say some other completely different restriction, for example. I mean, you can't have it arbitrary, obviously, because then everything's allowed. But
okay,
why that one?
Yeah, fair enough. You might be motivated to put other restrictions. I mean, coming from the most general probabilistic models, even quantum mechanics is a set of weird additional restrictions, right? In that sense. So I was just trying to follow the spirit of these generalized probabilistic theories where you take a kind of a phenomenological view of what an experiment is, that it has just two stages. There is the preparation and then there is the measurement. And you have a bit of a choice either in the preparation and in the measurement. And you just want to refer to the things that can occur in this very primitive setting. So that's kind of one of the constraints you get. I mean, that's the typical probabilistic theory stuff. Of course, you might be motivated to put other constraints, but I think whatever these constraints are, they will be contained in the constraints that I discussed, because you want that they are probabilities. That is, Wi are probabilities of measurements.
So, as I'm sure you know, there are certain compatibility structures that don't arise in quantum theory. So, you know, the simplest example is this one due to Ernst Specker, where you have three two-outcome measurements, and you're allowed to jointly measure any pair of them.
Yeah.
You can't measure all three at once. And that doesn't arise in quantum theory, because if I have three Hermitian operators, every pair of which commute, then all three commute.
Oh, I see.
So I could draw a compatibility structure that I can conceive of. You know, I can conceive of this triple of measurements, but I don't find any such triple in quantum theory. So I just wonder whether you've given any thought to whether graph theory provides some tools. You know, if I give you an arbitrarily complicated graph for the compatibility structure, you know, does it arise in quantum theory?
So first of all, to clarify, your notion of compatibility structure also includes incompatibility, right? I mean, this example of Speker, it also contains information that the following set of three is certainly not compatible. I mean, it's a negation that is kind of the way I set it up is a bit awkward to formulate it, because it's something that only that refers to the model. It kind of it says, you know, you're only allowed to consider models where somehow there is no way of doing this. And this, I mean, I'm just saying this is I mean, the way Speker formulated this is logically very nice, but it's difficult to transport in this setting. So I'm not sure if graph theory will tell you a lot about this, because I feel that it might be very awkward to even formulate this property. Right? I mean, do you understand what I mean? This formalism here only talks about these are certain contexts. These are certain compatible outcomes. It doesn't mean that others are not compatible. That's the strength in my view, because it allows us to even the most restrictive model, class of models, has a realization for every compatibility structure, even though it might be very trivial, but it has one, so it's a maximum value of some inequality. But yeah, okay.
So obviously this fact that you're using projector-like effects or normalized effects,
yeah,
is really hard to test in a lab. So could you, I mean, is there any hope that you could say something for general effects, or is it obviously impossible?
I can, and it's not very nice, because you get right all the way up to the Gleason model. I mean, any set of expectation values that is compatible with Gleason has a realization with these Gleason constraints, that the sum is less than equal to 1, has a realization with the state and appropriate POVM elements. So it's not very nice. So it means, yeah, you're forced to ensure this, or you're doomed to believe it in your actual experiment.
Are there more questions? If not, let us thank Andreas and all the speakers of the session.
Okay, before you leave, there are a